Thank you, John. I'm Jimmy Powers over alcohol, and I'm extremely grateful to be here and grateful to see all of you here. John and his wife Tara asked me to speak, and they're a team. John tells you, and then Tara sweet talks you. And you know, every time I'm asked to speak anywhere, and I don't say it mostly, but I'm asked quite a bit, I feel as though it's my God giving me another assignment, and that's a great feeling. That's a powerful feeling. And something that I know but sometimes don't really realize is that when someone is asked to speak, and they do, they get a certain blessing for that. But I also know this, because I talk a lot on spirituality and spiritual growth, because to me that's what sobriety is. Those who ask me, like John and Tara, you see, if I get a blessing for being here tonight and speaking before this group, that blessing must pass through them, and they get blessed also. Did you know that? You learn a lot about spirituality, and I did, and I find it to be so dynamic and so exciting and so powerful in a sober life, because believe me, my friends, that's what sobriety is. I've often said, you know, just not drinking is just not drinking a day at a time, and someone can not drink for 6 months, 8 months, or a year, and still be sitting on their hands, as you might say, and still in these rooms wishing they were out there in the saloons or whatever, because they haven't engendered in any type of a spiritual life or a spiritual realm. And that's where sobriety is. Sobriety to me is not drinking a day at a time. Well, that's just not drinking. Not drinking a day at a time in absence of inner turmoil. Inner turmoil is that anger, resentment, pity, guilt, prolonged sadness, and which we come in these rooms for, and which I prayed to be relieved from, and found out that there was no way possible to be relieved from those inner negative emotions than unless I grow spiritually. So to me, I'm just talking about my God, my program, and what gives me an exciting day every day. I wake up in the morning and I don't care what's going on outside. I don't care what the 6 o'clock news said the night before. I don't care what's happening in my life, because I am spiritually sound and sober, that I know that today I am once again going to be a victor over the day rather than a victim of it. And many times I was a victim of each and every day of my life when I was out there struggling with a bottle in my hand and a drink before me and wondering, you know, where's the happiness that I'm looking for? Where's the enjoyment in life that I'm looking for? And every day, every week, every month, every year that I drank and drank and drank, it seemed to be further and further and further away from me. And thank my God and you people, I was led to this AA program. And when I came in here, I made up my mind. I don't know about anybody else. I wanted sobriety. I wanted all that I could get. I wanted the acme of it, the peak of it, the best there is. And I set my goal, my sights, and believe me, my friends, it's here. It's really here for each and every one of us. And you know, spiritual concepts and spiritual knowledge and spiritual laws, I don't know. They're not, you know, I don't find them in books. I don't find them hardly anywhere, but I ask my God to wake me up to them. And he says, ask and you shall receive. And so when I asked with sincerity, I'm receiving. And certain spiritual concepts I'm beginning to really believe and understand. And it's made a great change in my life. And it would make a great change in anyone else's that could understand spirituality and practice it in their sobriety, because that's what sobriety is. This big book asks us to do one thing after we put down the drink a day at a time. You know, I could go out and run 3 or 4 or 5 miles a day and I'd feel better health-wise, but it's not going to do anything for my sobriety. I could chop a few cord of wood in the winter when I used to live up north, and it's going to keep the house warm. That's great. Anything like that, you know, is nice. But to stay sober, to be sober, to get sober, and to stay sober, the big book says one thing after I put down the drink a day at a time, just one thing: spiritual progress. Spiritual progress. Try to overcome that. Go through your big book as many times as you want and try and overcome that, and you can't. It asks just one thing: spiritual progress. And without it, my friends, a person is just not drinking. And you know that the mind, the alcoholic mind that comes in here The alcoholic mind that comes in here will always want to drink. The alcoholic mind will always want to drink. The alcoholic mind will never be comfortable in these rooms. Did you know that? The alcoholic mind will always be sitting in here wishing it was out there in a saloon. I've seen people a year or two, and probably you have too, that they claim I got a year or two sobriety, but they're wishing they could drink like normal people do. You've heard that. Normal people. Alcoholics don't want to drink like normal people, but just to want to be able to drink again tells me there's a lack of a certain amount of spirituality in their what they call sobriety. So for me, this is important. And I only can talk about what works for me. What gives me, like I say, an exciting day every day. And my friends, it's spiritual growth. It's spiritual growth. And you know, I say we try to grow spiritually. We're not looking for spiritual perfection. But I'll tell you something. If my spiritual growth grows into perfection, so be it. I would love to be that way. I chaired a meeting up north, and a fellow said to me, well, I wouldn't want to be perfect. He says, it wouldn't be any fun. And I said, well, what you're telling me then is the closer you grow to God, the more boring your life would be, see? We have to understand how we think. You know, the alcoholic mind and the sober mind are two different minds. It's very simple, you know. How would you like to walk into a coffee shop? Well, we used to have them when I was younger, you know, in a diner or a coffee shop, and people would be sitting at the coffee counter in the booth, you know, and go in there, just walk into a coffee shop some morning and say, give them two guys another coffee, give that kid a glass of milk, have something yourself, you know, and put some money on the, and he looks like you're nuts. But you can walk into a bar full of strangers and say, give them two people another drink, and give this and that, and have something yourself, and everybody understands that. See, it's the alcoholic mind and the sober mind. We have to differentiate one from the other. And we can't do it unless we engender into spirituality. And it's so important to me. You know, when I said that I'm grateful and grateful to be here, gratitude is one of the cornerstones of my sobriety. Gratitude is one of the most powerful acts, one of the most powerful acts of spirituality that we can possibly possess. Do you know that if I am not grateful for what I have, I don't deserve anything more? If I'm not grateful for what I have, I probably won't be able to keep what I have much longer. Gratitude is so important. Plus, listen to this, and this is the spiritual concept. Gratitude, my friends, is a launching pad for increase. Increase. If I'm not grateful for what I have, I cannot increase that. If I only got a dime in my pocket, no way to turn, I take that dime out and bless it. I don't curse it. You bless it and watch it increase. That's the spiritual growth, the spiritual that we're talking about. So I have 3 areas of gratitude that, you know, I have many in my life, but 3 that I am so grateful for and so thankful for. Number 1 is I'm so grateful that finally I learned and understood that I was powerless over alcohol, powerless over the first drink. If I didn't know that, you know, like many times I said, well, I'm just going to cut back on my drinking, or I'm not going to drink for a while, and next thing you know, you're drunk again. You know, I had to understand that I was powerless over the first drink. And 2, an incentive and a desire to do something about it. And the 2nd is that there's rooms such as this that I can come to add to and improve upon my sobriety. And that's great. 2 areas of gratitude. 1, that I realize I'm powerless over alcohol. 2, there's a program that I can get sober in. But these 2 may not be enough. And they're not enough for many people. These 2 may not be enough to get me or keep me sober if I don't have the 3rd. The 3rd is I am so grateful, so dynamically grateful, that I have a daily desire to come to meetings or read the big book or talk to someone on the phone or whatever about sobriety. I have a desire to improve upon what I've got, because without that desire, my friends, I've seen a lot of people go back out them doors. No desire to get or stay sober. And so we must have that desire. And it's a powerful desire, because the strongest, most powerful desire I ever had was to drink a day at a time. And never thought that anything would overcome that. Never thought that I could sit in these rooms and not wish that I had a drink, or sit in these rooms and be comfortable without a drink. But my spiritual growth has done that for me. And I feel just as relaxed and just as exciting and just as powerful and just as dynamic as anyone can in any area of their life. And if I tell you, it's something great. The first speaker's meeting I went to up north when I got sober was in the basement of a church. It seems like they all were. It looked like... And there was a Catholic priest. It was a Lutheran church. And there was a Catholic priest who was a speaker, little Father Bill. God bless him. He was a great little man, you know. And he says, you know, he says, here I am, a Catholic priest, trying to get sober in the basement of a Protestant church. And, you know, it was so ironic because this is the program. It reaches out to all of us in all areas and everywhere. And it's just a beautiful program. And I can come here right now and you know, just see faces I've never seen before. And yet I know that I can embrace any one of you and you would embrace me in return or vice versa. And one of the most powerful, listen to this, one of the most powerful, powerful feelings and knowledge of being spiritually strong, being spiritually sound, having a powerful spiritual embodiment is this. I can say right now, truthfully, to each and every one of you in this room, that each and every one of you can add to my life, but not one of you can take from it. And that's powerful. That is great. You know, you learn to live with yourself first, and then you bring in the other. Seek ye first, and all will be added. It's just beautiful. But that's for me. That's just my sobriety. But you know, back in the year 1957, I don't know how any old any of you are, you know, 1957. Well, I'm still got to walk around all my life with a pocket watch, you know. People said, Jimmy, you're still living in the 40s and the 50s. But I was born in 32. We'll put it to get that part over with here. But in the year 1957, listen to this. In a solitary confinement cell in a New York State penitentiary, I had a dream. And I had a dream that by the time I left this earth, I would be a wealthy person. But never once did I think or understand that it was alcohol and or the pursuit of alcohol that had given me that penitentiary dilemma. But you know, in the year 1964, I was worth $52,500, dead or alive. And never once... Never once did I realize or did I feel or understand that alcohol and or the pursuit of alcohol had put that bounty on my head. I never realized that. In the year 1967, in the early years of a 40-year prison sentence in Attica State Prison where they had that infamous riot, I was working for 6 cents a day on a punch press machine. 6 cents a day, and never once realized that it was alcohol and or the pursuit of alcohol that had put me in such a high wage bracket. Never did I realize that. And that's the disease of denial, and that's what we have to get out of, and that's what we have to understand. It was devastating my life, and I never knew it, and I never understood it. But I do today, and I thank my God, you know, that I have the three incentives to come to these meetings especially on a daily basis, to understand what sobriety is and to pass it on to others to the best of my ability. Because my God says to me, he gives us all the Great Commission. The Great Commission, my friends, is to feed my sheep. That's what he asked me to do. And all of you too, whether you know it or not. Feed my sheep. And we're the lambs he's talking about. And the food are the spiritual truths. The spiritual truths we hear in these rooms, he wants us to pass it on to one another as the best we can. And that's what I'm doing tonight. And that's why I feel so grateful. And that's why if I get a phone call at 2:30, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, and it's someone who is sincere, you know, you might get a drunk once in a while, but whacked out or something, but if I know this person is hurting and sincere, never would I say or even think, do you know what time it is? Because I feel in my heart, I really, honestly, truthfully feel that God has selected me for the one for that person to call. Isn't that a great feeling? Isn't it great knowledge to know that? Did you ever look at speaking at meetings or sponsoring or answering phone calls in the middle of the night as God has asked you to do this for him? Wow. Well, my friends, I not only look at it that way, I know it to be true, and you should too. I'm so honored. I feel so great. I don't sit up waiting for these phone calls. But when they come, I know it's my next assignment. I know that, and I feel great about it. How the hell did I end up in Attica prison with 40 years? Well, it wasn't hard if you're living the way that I was living. You know, I went to high school. I'm a high school dropout. I said to a guy once when I was in high school, I'm 3 years in high school and I think I'm going to quit. And he said, 3 years in high school and you're going to quit, Jimmy? Come on, one more year and you graduate. And I said, no, I'm 3 years in high school and I'm still a freshman. He said, why don't you quit? So I did. But before I did, as a teenager in New York State, I won the Golden Gloves up there. Now, this has nothing to do with it, I don't think. But I used to walk pretty good and do road work occasionally. Not enough. But I won the Golden Gloves, and then I won the light heavyweight. And a year later, I fought and beat the fellow that won the heavyweight. And I was campaigning in central northern New York, Canada, and parts of Pennsylvania. I was headlining all the amateur shows. I mean, I was a big attraction. I was really a comer. And I said, wow, this is great. And so I trained to the best of my ability, and I was doing very well. And then one night I was out with a group of guys, and we're out this place out by the lake out there. And it was in the summer, and the doors were open. It was nice weather, and they were having their cold beers, and I was having my Coke or Pepsi or whatever. And finally, I said, let me try one of them beers. Now I'm about 19 years old, see? So let me try one of them beers. And everybody's drinking. I was always drinking Coke or Pepsi or something. So I had a beer, and wow. I said, give me another one. And I had another one, and wow, you know. I had six or seven that night, and boy, I was more than tipsy. I know I was. But you know what that tells me? You know, they talk about, you know, not only the disease of not denial, but being an alcoholic, that, what is it, the chemistry or chemical makeup. See, I never wanted to drink alcohol. I never had a reason to. It wasn't to be macho, or I was never much, you know, of a Don Juan, you know, dances and this and that. But I never felt I had to have a drink in me to do anything. But I drank seven beers, I think, that night. And the next morning, when I got up to do road work, I felt like a Giselle, a cheetah or something. The fastest, wow, fast and light and speedy. I said, hey, I'm going to incorporate this in my training, you know. And I did. I did, but I didn't realize then it ain't that I wanted to, it's that I had to. I was alcoholic. I started drinking from then on. And there was Jimmy, the guy that never drank or smoked or anything, that had won all this Golden Glove title and was beating everybody. Next thing you know, I wasn't in the gymnasiums. I was in the damn saloons. And after a while, I turned professional. And just before I turned pro and after I did, I began to feel one of the strangest and worst feelings I ever had in my life. Almost as bad as those headaches and heartaches and hangovers from the alcohol. And that was losing to people that I knew I could beat. And I never related it to alcohol. I just say, well, you know, I wasn't doing road work anymore. I wasn't training. I didn't eat right. This, making all kinds of excuses, but never putting my mind on the alcohol. And they matched me with a fellow out of New York City that was real good. We're both real comers. And the winner was, you know, was really supposed to make his way, was going to be on his way. And before the match, the fight promoter, he owned a bar in a restaurant and had all the fight pictures down and everything, and the fight crowd hung around there. But that's where we went down and signed for the fight. And he said to me, Jimmy, listen to this. You got these messages too, and probably, you know, like I say, I just slipped it like I would a left hand in the ring. He says, Jimmy, he says, before we sign, I want you to post an appearance bond. I says, an appearance bond? He says, yeah. I says, you mean that I'll show up? And he says, yeah. I says, come on, Norm. I said, it was Norm Rothschild. He was the most famous promoter at that time out of Syracuse on TV. And I says, come on, Norm. I says, this is my business. This is my life. I can, and besides, I can beat that bum. He says, no, Jimmy, here's what he said to me. I feel that there's too many saloons between your house and the War Memorial where you're going to fight. It's just what he said. And he says, I want to guarantee you're going to be there. And I didn't know what he really meant. I mean, I knew I drank. I knew I was getting drunk a lot. And I got someone and we put up the bond. And you know, between that, putting up the bond and fight night, I had quite a few classic drunks. And that night, I really, really lost to somebody that I really knew I could beat. And that was it. I said to myself, well, my last fight was in Scranton, New York, when that was a good fight town before the coal mills were shut down. That was in 1961, and coming back from Scranton, I said, it's either going to be boxing or boozing or something. But so I never went back in the gymnasiums after that. You know, I had a world of talent, and I had a nice little career ahead of me. And I don't lament over it. What are you going to do? And but in them days, like in the old movies, you know, the underworld, the mob figures hung around there, and I'm talking about organized crime, not hubcap thieves. And they thought I might be quite an asset to them. And, you know, it reminded me of when I first saw the Rocky movie, you know, he was out collecting. Same here. I said, Jimmy, we lay out a lot of money, you know, and sometimes these guys don't want to pay, you know. And, well, you know, like the exorbitant rates, interest rates, are worse than the credit cards, I'm telling you. And but anyway, they wanted me to go out and pick up this money, see? So I says, all right, now you might have to pressure a few. I knew what they were talking about and everything, see? So I had a new career. I didn't have to fill out an application. I didn't have to have a high school education, you know? So I went to work. I felt pretty good about it, you know, and I was making some money and this and that. But now I had to suffer for, you could say, that way of living, but I say that way of thinking. Thinking, thinking, thinking. It's all up here, my friends. Sobriety is all up here. Changing your thinking, changing your thinking. The alcoholic mind will always want to drink. Anyone who goes back out after a period of sobriety, it's not a spiritual thought. Did you ever look at it that way? It's not a spiritual thought for an alcoholic to drink again. Simply that. I go into a lot of the prisons and penitentiaries and jails, and one of the messages I leave, it's only a couple sentences. It's powerful to them. I see their jaws drop. I say, if you leave here, you know, meaning going out on parole or probation or whatever, if you leave here with the same mind that brought you here, you're going to come back. Huh. You got to change your thinking. If you don't change your thinking, you cannot change your life. Our little Ellen read the promises. Did you look at her? Look like Goldie Hawn, don't she? She's the cutest little devil. Yeah, she's a little cutie. But she read the promises. She read the promises. She read the promises. Do you know what a lot of people, I mean, they hear the promises. Do you know what a lot of people, you know, subconsciously don't realize? To them, she was reading the hopes. She was reading the dreams. She was reading the desires. She was reading the wants or the needs. But she was reading the promises, the promises. Wow, that means they're promised to us. They're promised to us in sobriety. Well, how come we don't all get them? Or how come that sucker over there got a little more than me? I mean, what's going on here? What's wrong with God? I thought he didn't favor. Well, you see, let me tell you something. You cannot drink for a week, for a month, for a year, for 5 years, for 10 years, for 20 years or more. The promises will never come to you. They won't. Spiritually, my friends, you must grow into them. You must go to them. You must grow into them spiritually. That's why. So they are promised to us, but we may not all ever receive them because we're not growing spiritually. We must grow into them. So don't sit and wait for it to happen. It ain't gonna. It's not promised that way. Then it becomes a wish and a hope and a desire. So these are spiritual facts that I learned, and I learned them the hard way, like all of us in these rooms are learning. But anyway, I was talking about picking up this money and whatever, and then I got a year in the pen. I said for that way of thinking, not so much that way of living. And, you know, I thought that God was teaching me a lesson, trying to straighten me out. You know, God put me in jail. Not the fact that I broke the law. It took me a long time, even after the 40 years, that I began to realize that I'm not punished for my sins. I'm not punished for my sins, and neither are you. But I'm punished by my sins. That's where the punishment comes, see. So I'm in there as a result of breaking the law, not because God's trying to teach me a lesson. But I come out of there on a cold day, and I went back into the ring and, you know, training, but more time in the saloons. Like I say, I fought in Scranton and everything. So listen to this. Now I'm involved with the underworld. And I really mean, you know, I don't use that word as freely as the Sopranos do. But they were the people I was involved with, and I was a big asset, even though I was Irish. And at one time I had my own Irish mob, and that's when they gave me 40. They said, this kid's growing too fast. So, in 1964, just living that way of life, listen to this, 1964, this is just 1 year out of my life. In 1964, I was arrested and charged in Chautauqua County, that's down below Buffalo, New York, 9 counts of forgery. And the state's attorney comes in, he says, now this guy ain't writing checks and ain't passing them, but he's heading a statewide forgery ring that's netting quite a few $1,000 a week. We got to get him off the street. Well, I made bail and went back in the saloons. And then in Onondaga County, where I live, Syracuse, New York, I got indicted on 54 counts of forgery. Now, once again, I made bail and went back into the saloons. In 1964, I got indicted on accessory to robbery. And I made bail and went back into the saloons. And in 1964, I got indicted again for robbery in the first degree. Now, the bonding companies were beginning to think I was becoming a risk. And so they kind of backed off. The judge gave an impossible bail, and my lawyer says, what's going on? And I says, well, I don't know. So he says, well, the judge that's got all your cases is going on vacation, and there's another judge sitting in for a couple of weeks. I'm going to go to him and see if we can't consolidate all the bails into one, and maybe we can get you out of here. So I says, okay. So he goes out, and he was a good criminal lawyer. That's one thing we did have, is good criminal lawyers. But he come back, and he's shaking his head in the visit room. He says, Jimmy, what the hell did you do out there? And I says, what are you talking about, Frank? And he says, well, he says, that judge I just talked to about your bails. Yeah. He says, well, he says he's one of the guys you swindled. Yeah. I forgot. He owned a building, and, you know, we kind of took it out from under him, and I didn't know it was a judge. I was dealing with his son, but he didn't tell me the father was the judge. I said, oh, great. So I sent for some pajamas. And you know what? Yeah, and you know what? In the summer of 1964, the same year, I gets indicted by the federal government on a $450,000 postal money order swindle, as they called it. You know, this is what they call flim-flam and confidence scores. How come they call it confidence score, con score? He's a con man. It means that I gained their confidence in me to be able to do this, to take money from people. And it's always when they find out that they got beat, and then somebody, sometimes if they find out it's you and they look at your picture or see you, the first thing they say to the police is, oh no, not that nice man. He wouldn't do it. And I'd say, see? But see didn't always work. I remember when I was out there, you know, on bail into the saloons and back on bail and my lawyer says to me, he says, Jimmy, he says, these cases are mounting up. And I says, well, I know it. He says, they're piling up. He says, I'm going to need some more money. He says, you got to get some more money. I don't care how you do it. And I says, that's just it. I've been doing it. But every time I do it, I get another indictment. I had 5 indictments. And I was still on bail. But the windup is, I went to trial on the robbery one. I had a safe conviction. I'm just breezing through it. I was a safe cracker, too. And my daughter knows, so what's the difference? Dad was a safe cracker. So it would have been my second felony, and I got convicted after trial, and I stood to get 60 years. Don't do nothing in New York, my friends. 60 years is the max. But I had changed in prison. I'm not going to get out there and take advantage of anybody anymore. What the change was, I just was an all-around good guy. I had a little money out in front and buy this one cigarettes and do this. And I was uneducated, in a sense, school-wise, but I could write letters and all, and I'm helping guys write their family or write their lawyers. People couldn't really express themselves. So what I was doing was I was changing my thinking in many ways. And when I went up for sentencing, instead of getting 60 years, I only got 40. And boy, did I feel great. I realized later on, just changing my thinking, I beat him out of 20 years. and they sent me up to Attica, you know, in a snowstorm and a blizzard and everything, and they had shackles on my legs, and they had this big leather belt with cuffs on each side, and state police in front and back, and prison guards and all that, because they heard the boys might try to break me out. I said, that's ridiculous, you know. But they got me up there, and they got me into the prison, and you're in this reception for a couple of weeks, and they want to study, you know, they come by and they look at you, holy Christ, this 40 years, what'd you do, son? You know, so they sent me the service unit guy, and he says, well, Jimmy, he's got my record and everything. He says, you know, Jimmy, he says, you're going to be with us for quite a while. Now, this is 1964 when my time started. These guys may not even been around then. Next couple years is 2004, so it only sounds like a couple years, but from 64 to 2004, this is what we're talking about. He says, Jimmy, he says, you're going to be with us for quite a while. And I says, oh, what do you mean? And he says, well, your maximum expiration date is August of 2004. I said, what? Because this was 64. And he says, August of 2004. And I said, oh, I thought you said September. And that's what you have to do time, not do hard time, my friends. You just got to keep a good attitude and whatever. And anything in life, I don't care. You got to have the right attitude or you're going to sink. You're going to sink. Well, anyway, they had the Auburn riots and the Attica riots, and I stood in the riots. I'm going to get into all that. But they shortened my sentence because of the riots. They modified the old laws. I was supposed to go 13 years and 9 months to even see the parole board, and I had all these other indictments in front of me. But they said I only had to do 8 years and 4 months to see the board. And I saw the board. Now, because in prison, I decided, you know, I wasn't giving myself a good life and this and that. And I don't care what anybody thinks, them guys out there, this and that. That's it. I've had enough of it. I'm changing my life. And I started reaching out to others in prison. And listen to me. I'm talking about immediate miracles in my life. Just like right now, if you start changing your thinking from that friggin' alcoholic mind to a sober mind, you will begin to witness and experience miracles in your life. Not even asking for them. Not even looking for them. And they'll appear. I go up there, and they're going to tell me, give us a couple more, give us a couple more. You know what to do, Charlie Manson, a couple more years of death, a couple more years, a couple more years, 18 months, you know. They told me to go home. Get out of here, kid. I said, holy Christ, I couldn't believe it. Now, when I left there, miracle number two. I got 3 more indictments or 4 more from the state and 1 from the federal government. There's usually a fight out in front, which one's going to get me, right? And I go out in front, and there's nobody there. Except my friends that picked me up. Joey owned a bar, and he picked me up. My brother-in-law was with him, and they got me out of there. I says, holy Christ. So there it is. What happened to them indictments? That was in 1973, my friends, when I got out, and I have never, never, to this day, ever heard one word of them indictments. They evaporate like cigarette smoke. They're gone. They're just gone. Because God knew my heart. He knew that I was changing. He knew it. If I was double-minded and you know, like some people go to programs in prison just to make parole, God knows that. 2 miracles. 1, going to the board earlier, having my sentence cut. Number 2, nobody out there to pick me up with another indictment. And this is it. And number 3, I drank for almost a year, 11 months. I was getting wacky with the booze. I couldn't see straight anymore. And I was led to this AA program. And believe me, that alone was a miracle. For any one of us, it was a miracle, a miracle, a miracle. And when I came in here, I immediately wanted it. I had a desire to find out what this sobriety was and to get it. And you know, when I came in here, I didn't understand nothing. I'm sitting there at my first couple meetings, you know, my mind cleared up a little bit, and I was listening to some people, and these guys were talking about, you know, them things on the wall. Well, this is a church. Well, one of them says, let go and let God. One says, think, think, think. One says, easy does it. I said, what the hell is this? Sesame Street? What the hell am I in here? I'm in here. What is all this, you know? This is what was going to get me sober and change my life? This old-timer stood up, and he says, yeah, he says, let go and let God. And he says, easy does it. He says, easy does it, but do it. I says, well, I had a motto in that old life. And he says, what's that? And I said, take it easy, but take it. He says, yeah, but look what it got you, 40 years in the slammers. And I says, well, you're right. So I started listening. I began to realize this is philosophy. You know, philosophy ain't nothing but common sense explained. You can read some of the greatest philosophers. I read a few when I was in the joint. You know, I was trying to better edumacate myself. I said, Francis Bacon and a few. And you know what? When you read it, you say, almost like, well, I knew this. I knew that. You really do. And so, you know what? I'll tell you something else. I mean, I can say I heard something new or I heard something better in the program or I read something that was new. But I know deep down inside, I mean, we all use that statement. Let me tell you something. Nothing is new to you. Nothing is new to me if it's spiritual. Did you know that? All it is waking up that which is already inside you. God completed us. He made us complete. Did you know that all the wonders we seek in life are already in here? They're already here. You don't have to go out there and reach around for happiness. When I was a kid, they had a radio program, The Search for Happiness. And some of the happiness can't be found. And, you know, you're going out there and it's like a cloud or something. I'm trying to grab happiness. All us tall guys would get it. You know, we'd win. We'd win, and some guy'd have a gimmick to get it before I could or something. Search for it. It's in here. Let me tell you, let me just explain why I know this. A woman come to me once, Jimmy, I wish I had your patience. And I says, you wish you had my patience? She says, yeah. I says, well, I don't know what you're saying. She says, well, I get upset very easy and this and that, and I don't have much patience. And I says, well, right now we're talking. It's right after a meeting. Do you have patience now? She says, yeah. And I says, what you're saying is that if something traumatic happens, you would surrender or give up your patience to take on a wild or negative attitude. Oh, yeah. I says, well, I wouldn't. You see, you're praying to God, and you know what he's saying to you? You're saying, please, God, give me patience. And he's saying, why do you pray to me for what I've already given you? Hang on to it. That's all. Learn how to hang on to it. Take the value off getting upset. Take the value off being negative. Take the value off anger, resentment. There's no value in it. Ain't how, no more do me any more good than a drink. And listen to this, my friends. Just listen to this. The strongest, most powerful obsession I ever had in my life was to drink on a daily basis. Nothing stronger. Look what it did to me. I know what it did to a lot of you. I had a wife. She divorced me when I went away, when I got to 40. She came up with a lawyer. I said, Sal, what's is the alcoholic mind? Sal, what's the matter? I only got 40 years. Can't you wait? Can't you wait? You know, what the? I had a baby daughter. Jeez. Take the value off being a piss pot. Take the value off being the dominant one in your home. Take the value off of getting anger and upset. If there's no value, there's no value in a drink for me today, my friends. No value whatsoever. There's no obsession because there's no value. I don't return to it because it has no value in my life. Now, if it has still had value, I just might sneak out one night and try one. But it has no value. Anger, resentment, pity, guilt, no value. No value. It's destructive. It's destructive. And it comes here first before it comes down there. Did you know that? Did you know that? Listen to this. These are spiritual truths. I'm just passing them on. No, why don't I just speak for myself? No way can I feel angry unless first I think angry. Anger is an emotion. I can't get that emotion unless first it comes up here. I cannot feel angry unless first I think angry. No way can I feel resentful unless first I think resentful. I must think resentful first. No way can I feel guilty or pitiful unless first I think guilty or pity first. Then it comes down here. Listen to this. Here's a good one. No way, no possible way can I feel cheerful unless first I think cheerful. And we choose our own thoughts. I mean, sometimes they have what they call race thoughts. They rush in our minds, but as long as we hold on to them, if we recognize them as negative, as long as we hold on to them, then it's up to us. Then it's up to us. So if you want to be angry or resentful or pitiful or guilty, hang on to that thought, and you'll have it, man. As long as you think about it, If you want to be a success as far as a spiritual success in life and in sobriety, kick it out like you would the thought of a booze, of taking a drink. You can do it. Do you think the thought of taking a drink to an alcoholic now has no value in my life? Don't you think if God, with my cooperation, can rid myself of that? What's the problem with anger? I mean, that answers the question of those, oh, Jimmy, everybody gets angry. Everybody gets pissed off. No. Speak for yourself. Not everybody. I don't. And you know why I don't? Now you can look at me. You can call me a liar. You can stone me out in the parking lot after. But I'm telling you the God absolute truth, because I am on a spiritual plane. There's no anger up here. There's no thought of a drink, taking a drink for an alcoholic up here. It's not up here. But if I quit coming to meetings and quit seeing and talking to all you beautiful people and throw away my big book, my thoughts will drop down to where it was, back down to that alcoholic level. And the next thing, when something traumatic happens, I'll say, maybe I'll take a drink, just maybe. But if I'm on that spiritual plane, it don't happen. Let me tell you something else about how powerful that spiritual plane is. Listen to this. Whew. I am not going to drink tomorrow. I'm not. Now, I've got 28 years sober. You don't say that, Jimmy, especially when newcomers are around or people haven't had much time. You don't say you're not going to drink tomorrow. Nobody should. We just took one day at a time. But listen to this. I'm not going to drink tomorrow as long as I'm thinking as good as I'm thinking today. Ah. And as good as I think and feel every morning when I wake up, I try to add to it. Like I can add a little bit on Monday. God don't hide no wisdom from me. I can find it in the big book. I can find it at a meeting. I can find it from someone of you. If I say, Lord, I want something to add to what I got. Tuesday, I got a little more. Wednesday, I got a little more. Thursday, Friday and Saturday, by the weekend, I'm dynamite. And I got the rest of my life to keep growing. Did you ever look at it that way? Rather than just come to meeting. I go to meetings so I don't drink. Everything's with emotion. You know what reaches down here? The subconscious puts everything into effect. Did you know that? Well, you know it now. So here's what happens. Yeah, let me tell you how it happens. I'll tell you how it happens. It happens with emotion. You know, you reach the subconscious through emotion. So every day in your life, where you're working, you're at school of some sort or whatever, somebody's going to say, or they might even walk to a meeting, Jimmy, that son of a bee, he cut me off down there in the high, blah, blah, blah. Everything negative is done with emotion, powerful emotion, and people wonder why they stay negative, you see. Hey, how you doing? Oh, okay. Having a good day? Yeah. No emotion. Anything good? No emotion. I can't control my good feelings. Man, I spout them out. I feel dynamic inside. I don't know if you can sense it or not, but I do. And I'm just 2 years and four operations from what they call cancer. I was 52 pounds lighter than I am now. Walking with this cane, I was so hollow. My eyes looked like they were falling out. And I prayed once when they told me I had it and showed the x-rays. I prayed once to God, remove this evil spirit or whatever it is. Just once. And every day after that, I thanked him. I thanked him. I thanked him for healing me. I thanked him. Not that he was healing me, not that he's going to heal me. I thanked him for healing me. My God heals. He don't say, well, I'm going to let you wait a year or two because you got two felonies or something like that. He heals right away. See, that's the faith. We have to live on faith. And, phew, they found it somewhere else. They found it somewhere else. Now they don't know where it went. And I keep eating and getting heavier. I'm almost back. I was 215. I went down to 155. Wow. One guy thought I was a broomstick once. He was going to sweep the walk with me. I said, I'm not a broomstick. I'm sick. I didn't say I was sick because you never admit to it. I listen to the radio and there's a commercial on about some arthritic pills or something. There's something new is supposed to be real good. And this woman says, well, when my arthritis flares up, I take these pills. You see, as long as you claim it, you got it. That's what God says. As long as you claim it, you got it. That's why I claim my healing every day. And wow, nobody. Jeff takes me to lunch. Jeff and Caroline. They don't want to do that no more. I eat them out of house and home. I'm healed. I don't care what the x-rays say. I mean, I don't tell the doctors that. God will tell them sooner or later, you know. Wasting your time and money on this guy. He's healed. So that's it. But, you know, telling my story, and wow, what kind of time is it? Let me bring out the old one. Exactly. See how God works? Exactly 9 o'clock. Am I supposed to clam up, or am I supposed to turn at 9? I can talk a few more minutes? All right. I'm just getting warmed up, but I'll tell you something. Oh, I am. There's so much that wants to come out. But I'll tell you something now. When I was in Auburn prison, I transferred from Attica to Auburn to be closer to home and my lawyers. Auburn's only 25 miles outside of Syracuse, where I lived. That's a big old prison. And so I was in that prison, and I was clerk in B block, as they call it. Can you imagine me? I never used a typewriter. I kept the count. I made out the count slips and everything. The guys taught me how to go bing, 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 you know. And I got the job, you know, what they call a plush job in prison. Yeah, 25 cents a day. Wow, I couldn't believe it. The money I was making, wow, from 6 cents up there in that punch press machine. So I'm clerk in B block for about 6 years, the longest I ever held a job. It was great. But I started reading books, you know. I never read a lot. I started reading books, and I didn't really get into the Bible, and I didn't really understand that at the time, and I didn't know enough to ask God for the wisdom and knowledge to interpret and understand what I read, which I do now, and I can do a lot better. But I was reading books about successful people. Some were just salesmen, but boy, it was so exciting. And most of these people, I read about guys like Bernard Baruch, who were self-made millionaires, advisors to presidents. I mean, the reason I read about it, to see where they came from nothing, and every one of them talked about a certain spiritual element that they had in life. But I'll kind of close with this, because I'll forget that I'm not supposed to keep talking. I read The Agony and the Ecstasy. Maybe you've seen it. They made a movie on it recently about Michelangelo. And Michelangelo, you know, he painted that Sistine Chapel. It was incredible, the beauty of that painting. It took him 7 years to do it, and so incredible. And he did he did another painting of the Holy Family, but he didn't want to paint. You see, the Pope commissioned him in them days. You do this, and you had to do what he told you. He loved to sculpt. He loved marble. He loved marble so much that he once said that marble was his mistress. I said, wow. But he did. He loved to sculpt and refine it and rub his hands over it and everything. And the Pope wouldn't have him do these, a lot of these statues in bronze. He'd make him do it in bronze. He wanted to sculpt. Well, anyway, come to the statue of David. And Michelangelo was the Pope commissioned to do David. And that's where David, I'm left-handed, and about, I think David was standing. He had the slingshot over one shoulder, and he's standing like this. And if you've seen pictures of the statue, I'm sure you all had. But I had a friend of mine that went over to Florence, Italy, and that's where the statue is. He said, Jimmy, I saw the statue, and you have to see it to believe it, to understand the genius in this man. I says, well, what are you talking about? And he says, when he's standing like this, he says, on this side where he's leaning, in the marble, listen to this, in the marble you can see and feel the tenseness of him. And on the other side, you can see and feel relaxation. That's how genius this guy was. Well, when they unveiled it, you know, the Pope and the centurions and all them guys were there, and they unveiled the statue to the public, and everybody stood in awe. And, you know, they said to Michelangelo, my God, how did you, you know, create such a beautiful thing out of that piece of marble? And he says, I didn't. And he says, well, you did. We know you did. The Pope commissioned you, and a lot of us come up and watched you at times to do it. We know you did it. He said, that ain't what I meant. He says, well, what do you mean? He says, that statue was always inside that block of marble. He said, all I did was chip away and chip away and chip away till I got to it. Then I polished it and refined it. And there's this beautiful thing that you're all looking at. And in closing, my children, I will say this. Inside in each and every one of us are all the wonders we seek in life. You have to believe it. You've already got happiness. You've already got inner joy, inner peace. You've already got it. Don't go out there looking for it. You might get lost in the woods or somewhere, you know. It ain't out there. It's already in here. All we have to do is chip away and chip away and chip away till we get to that new and better and beautiful you. And one day at a time, we can all stay sober and enjoy life. Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to give out the birthday chips. And I'm going to call up, I'm just going to go down the list in the way they're shown, in no particular order. And the first one on the list is Deborah R., and Beth L. is going to give her chip.
Hey, I'm Beth Lester, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Beth.
And it's such a privilege to give Deborah her one-year chip. I've never actually been able to give anybody like a medallion or anything, and it's such. Deborah's been so special in my life, and I met her like a week after I moved here, and she came up to me and asked me to sponsor. She didn't know me from anybody, and she didn't know what she was getting into. And it's been just a complete high spot in my life working with her, and I've learned so much through our relationship, and it's just. You've meant so much to me, and I just so value you and your friendship. And
hi, everybody. My name's Deborah Revis, and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't expect that this would happen. And this past year, I certainly, myself, have taken the road less traveled by. Certainly by me. sobriety was not something I would choose for myself. Jimmy, I was a lot like you. I had a very strong compulsion to drink every day. I have some very mixed emotions about picking up this chip tonight. My sobriety date is the 1st of September. And after the day passed, I went into a very deep depression. And I realized that I have some sort of reservation that I haven't figured out yet. And Jimmy, while you were talking, I, for a moment, started feeling ashamed of the spiritual path that I've walked these past 365 plus days. And then I listened some more, and I realized that shame is something that I choose not to feel. I choose to be grateful. Thank you.
Lindsay G. and Richard G. is going to, she has 26 years.
That was Jim.
Oh, there's Charlene. You are here.
Hi, I'm Richard. I'm a member of Al-Anon. Real quick, last year, September 1st, we left Atlanta in a motorhome to follow the sun. And Lindsay's chip says 9/11, 1976. And on 9/11, we were in Laura, Alabama. And a lot of heroes were created that day. And I got to tell you, in the past 12 months, I've found a hero in my life. And Lindsay has been through more things in the past 12 months than I can imagine, up to and including yesterday. but I'm just here to wish her a happy birthday for 26 years and honoring me to make me a part of that. And I love you very much, and thank you.
My name's Lindsay. I'm alcoholic.
And what a blessing you were tonight. You filled me. I was just wonderful. And, you know, I too have cancer, but I too am healed. You know, but if I wouldn't go running and fall and break things, I'd be okay. But that also must be a blessing of some kind. But anyway, it's a long story. We can do great meetings on it. But this has been an interesting year for me, but I'd like to say there's people in this room that have been the most supportive, the kindest, the most giving, the most unselfish that I've ever met. I've got a couple of my running friends here that are coming to meetings and go to meetings with me that I'm so grateful they're here tonight. And they, my doctor asked me, and I'll be quick because I know there's a million birthdays, but you know what? It's just such a neat day for me today. And last year was such a tragic day, and I'm so grateful for my sobriety and my family and my wonderful husband, the best, Al-Anon. And I think he's the number one Al-Anon. Charlene can be number two. But I just have to say that the blessings in my life are so rich, and the people are so rich. My doctor asked me, he read my file, I was an alcoholic, and he asked me about it, and I said, you know, I've had hundreds of cards, hundreds. And he said, well, it must be you. And I said, no, it isn't me. It's the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And that's the truth. And cancer's no big deal. It's not the worst thing that happened. If I were to go back out and drink, that would be the worst thing that happens. And I want to wish the rest of y'all happy birthday. And some of y'all are just so special, but I really appreciate it. And I don't know if Steve A. is here, and Jennifer, and there's some people, and Don and Charlene, who've taken care of me, and I really appreciate it. And I'm sorry I'm so long, but you were truly a blessing tonight, and I loved it. It's a bit of the Irish we all need.
Thanks. Kathleen, and Jerry's going to give her chip. She's got 14 years.
I'm Jerry, and I'm in Al-Anon.
Hi, Jerry.
And Kathleen said, don't talk too much, and don't talk long, she said, and don't say anything good about me. So I just want to say quickly that that's exactly how I met Kathleen. I'm one of the lucky people. You know, when people say, oh, I was here when you came in, I think I saw her when she was coming in. And I was kind of proud of myself because I was good because of my job. I'd look at people and I knew. I could kind of tell the ones that were going to, quote, make it and the ones who weren't. And I knew. I looked at Kathleen, and there were two things about her that she was really cute. And she had these cute clothes on. So I had Dunwoody Housewife stamped on her forehead, you know, for me. So I said, she'll never make it. So it was my job to tell her a little bit about where she was coming into. So after I looked at her and knew she wasn't going to make it, I told her what I thought she would want to hear. I said, we have a swimming pool, and there's a tennis court, you know, so, and her eyes lit up, you know, I thought, because I wouldn't bother telling her that maybe she would have a better life or, you know, that sobriety could do all this stuff. But she seemed to be happy, and then I thought, well, I was pleasing her so much, I said, we're like a Holiday Inn here. So then she really thought, I'll come here. And then as she went into detox, I hid, because I never wanted to see her again in treatment after I had told her what a wonderful place she was coming to. But the fun that Kathleen and I had over the years is I have seen her many times, and we always kind of laugh, and she always says, yeah, Holiday Inn, ha, ha, ha. But the fact is, it has been such a lesson to me to see somebody who I thought was not going to make it. And one of the things I think that happens to everybody is everything good happens to them with sobriety. And with Kathleen, so many bad things happened. And each bad thing that happened, she seemed to grow a little more. And I'd see her, and I'd say, how's it going? And she'd tell me, and then one thing about being around this program where none of us ever supposedly know anything about the other, we always know everything that's pretty much going on. And I would hear the stuff about Kathleen, and it just was such an honor tonight when she asked me to give her a chip, because for somebody I didn't think was going to make it, and I've watched her grow, and she's a beautiful lady from being just a cute Dunwoody housewife. Congratulations.
Thank you.
My name's Kathy McVine. This is 14 years, and it seems like yesterday. And I met Jerry. I had a DUI the night before and was arrested and taken to jail, and I went to Peachford outpatient or something. I don't know. But she was there, but she failed to tell me that all those things would be locked. And the room I had was there was a sliding door, but it was locked, and you weren't allowed to go anywhere or do anything. And then later when I saw her in the hospital, I said, you know, this isn't even like a Best Western. It was horrible. But she was my Eskimo, and I owe my life to her, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I just wanted to wish everybody else a happy birthday, and to Lindsay especially. I've had breast cancer. I had early on when I was in sobriety, and I had problems with it for probably 5 to 10 years, but she handles it with grace, and what a role model. I thank everybody who came before me. Thank you.
Doug B's got 23 years, and Ernie L's going to give him his chip.
My name's Ernie Cook, and I'm an alcoholic. Unlike Kathleen, Doug told me to talk long and tell everything good about him. That doesn't come as any surprise to anybody, I'm sure. A little over 20 years ago, a man brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll always be grateful for that. And he told me when I got here that I needed to pick out the people who were really sincere about this program. And I said, well, how will I know who those people are? He said, oh, well, they'll tell you. And so I picked out Doug, and he told me. And as the years went by, I found out he was crazy as hell, just like the rest of us. But over that 20-year period, Doug has been here and has been a role model for me, and I love you, buddy. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ernie. I'm Doug. I'm an alcoholic. Lindsay, I love you. I know you've been through a tough one, and you're doing just super with it, too. It makes everything else kind of fall in perspective when you talk about having bad days or bad years. And I don't have anything to say. If you keep coming back, if you're new, if you keep coming back in here long enough, you're bound to get sober. I mean, you just have to come. There ain't no possible way to do this, though, without going to meetings. I mean, you can't do it. You got to go to meetings. And, you know, at 23 years, I'm still going 2 or 3 a week. And, of course, part of that is I ain't got nowhere else to go. But it will. I mean, if you really want to get sober, you can do it if you're just... and you can even be, you know, about half asshole like I am. And still not drink. But it does work. Thank you very much.
And Les P. has got 11 years, and Donna P. is going to give him his chip.
My name's Donna. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Jimmy, for your story. And this is Les. You guys know Les. I'm going to keep this really short. Les is, to me, an incredible person. And I tell you, I'm honored to spend my life with him. And happy 11th birthday.
My name is Les. I'm an alcoholic. Jimmy, that was a powerful message. I appreciate you sharing with us. It was. Real quick, because I know we're hot and we want to get out of here. Lindsay, everybody who's celebrating, you know, this has just been a magical night, I think, for me anyway. I want to thank God, and I want to thank this group, and I want to thank my wife, Donna. Sobriety's great.